August 21st, 2018, marked the first day of the National Prison Strike, a two-week-long boycott of unfair labor practices and unethical treatment of prisoners within the U.S. incarceral system. The story of how this strike connects to UW, just like the story of the Real Food Challenge, also starts on Red Square. Once again, the square was empty, with barely anyone to witness the small group of protesters going into Suzzolo Library and then Gerberding Hall. Thankfully, the Facebook group named Washington State Joins the National Prison Strike captured it all on Facebook Live, and I'm able to share the audio footage from that day courtesy of Amani Sawari. Amani is a spokesperson for the group Jailhouse Lawyers Speak and is a part of the Washington Solidarity Group, which demonstrated on Red Square that day. Amani was also there, educating onlookers about the grim realities of the prison industrial complex in the United States, and outlining the demands that the prisoner-led coalition has prepared for the strike. The 10 demands largely concern the quality of life within prisons, opportunities for rehabilitation, and the conditions on the outside that lead to incarceration. Those demands were included in the letter that the Washington Solidarity Group delivered to the office of UW President Ana Marie Cauce, who, coincidentally, was not there to receive it. While it's not unusual to see a bunch of students protesting on campus, it still might seem odd. Why is President Cauce being approached about this? What can she possibly do in relation to this nationwide issue? What connection could students have to prisons in the first place? If you were to pose these questions to students on campus, you would get a wide variety of answers. Some would be equally as confused, while others would know exactly how UW students, the administration, and state prisons are all intertwined. State law requires the University of Washington to purchase a portion of their goods from an inmate work program within the Washington State Department of Corrections. As students, we inevitably use products that the UW has purchased from these prisons. And if you're a student who wants to seek institutional change to promote ethical purchasing practices, it makes sense to go straight to the president, right? Hi, welcome to The Civil Experiment, the podcast that explores student political engagement through a social scientific lens. I'm your host, Neva Ashkenazi. Today, we look at another instance of a student-led effort to redirect the university's spending, this time away from prisons in Washington State, or really anywhere. Back in 2016, students began their fight to get the university to divest from prisons, consistently facing new administrative dead ends while trying different approaches to the cause. At this point in the back and forth, the amount of leverage that students might actually have is more limited than they originally thought. One of the points of entry into student involvement in the prison divestment effort on campus is through the student group United Students Against Sweatshops, or USAS for short. Second-year student Guy Oron is a member.
Yeah, and we at USAS, we look at like the definition of sweatshops as like a broader kind of any workplace that denies workers' rights. And so there's many sweatshops in the U.S., for example, as well as abroad. That's why we've kind of, I think, focused more on labor solidarity. And so not just doing campaigns abroad, but also like partnering with unions and showing up, especially like campus workers, like we're the ones paying tuition, so we should kind of use that power like to make sure workers are being treated fairly.
USAS has endorsed the prison strike and stood in solidarity with Jailhouse Lawyers Speak, which has been at the forefront of the movement.
Prisons are the most glaring example in the U.S. of a workplace that denies humans, like people, rights. Historically, it is a continuation of slavery. Right after the Civil War, a bunch of laws were passed in the South to criminalize former slaves. It was called convict leasing, and to force folks to work on plantations. And after that was shut down, the prison system, the carceral system, has been used time and time again to basically enforce white supremacy and to also enforce class privileges. So not just benefiting all white people, but especially like white rich people. The 13th Amendment itself has an exemption clause abolishing slavery, but except for punishment of a crime. And so what prisons today have some sort of work system where They can like essentially force prisoners to work and often pay them like a couple cents an hour, like somewhere around like a couple dollars a day.
Not only is this true, it's also reinforced in state law. Any supplier that wants to do business with a state agency, like a public university, for instance, will be given a preference over other suppliers if their products are manufactured, at least in part, by an inmate work program. Inmate work programs differ among prisons in Washington state. There are federal prisons, like the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, that are operated by private contractors, like GEO Group, in which the work prisoners do is either to run the facility or to generate revenue used to maintain it. There are also publicly owned and state-run prisons, which may all have some degree of private involvement. In the Washington State Department of Corrections specifically, all prison facilities house businesses run by a public entity called Correctional Industries, whose main purpose, much like private prisons, is to ultimately generate enough profit to maintain those inmate work programs. Of course, Correctional Industries advertises itself as more than that. On their website, they claim to provide professional development opportunities to prisoners, supposedly helping them get jobs upon release. They also say they reduce taxes for state agencies that would normally go to state prison. In actuality, these programs are doing very little to save money for the state. In the fiscal year 2018, a Department of Corrections report indicated that it could cost between $30,000 and $40,000 annually to keep one person incarcerated. Those rates are similar in other states.
Keeping a person incarcerated in Michigan costs $40,000 a year. That was more than my education. That's just completely unnecessary for us to be wasting all of this money subsidizing companies making billions of dollars.
That's Imani Sawari. We got a chance to sit down for an interview back in late September when she explained the main motivations behind the prison strike for financial reasons, but most importantly, for societal and political ones as well.
Definitely an economic decision where the government decides to invest so much money, and the fact that billions of dollars are being invested into just simply keeping people in cages is completely illogical in a lot of ways. Prisons are not a necessary aspect for societal functions. There are many alternatives to keeping someone incarcerated. And the reason why we would choose to pick an alternative option is because we want to invest in a person.
There are also serious doubts that these work programs actually help prisoners get employed. A Seattle Times investigation in 2014 found Correctional Industries could not provide data that shows where former inmates are working. And although state law prohibits public sector employers from discriminating against ex-felons, private sector employers are free to do so as long as felony status is not the sole reason for disqualification. And since almost all hiring processes are competitive, in practice, felony status inevitably leads to a former inmate not getting employed.
Our corrections department should be focused on correcting. It should be focused on rehabilitating. It should be focused on bringing healing back into communities. And there's no way that we can bring a full cycle of healing back into a community without adequately preparing someone for returning to the community. And, you know, there should be no label that you place on a human being that allows us to treat them less like a human being. And it gives this illusion of helping to make our community safer, but we already know that just because we incarcerate more people, that doesn't mean that our communities are safer. It's an illusion, and it's an illusion that allows prison officials to hire more guards and waste more money.
So this is what we mean when we talk about the insidious nature of prison labor. And yes, the University of Washington is very closely implicated in this entire structure. UW conducts business with Correctional Industries mainly through buying dorm furniture from Stafford Creek Correctional Center, located 5 miles west of the city of Aberdeen. Here's how these transactions actually work. Correctional Industries purchases mostly pre-built furniture from private companies. Then, prisoners do some sort of labor that often does not even entail manufacturing the furniture itself. Then, Stafford Creek sells those products to state agencies at ridiculously low prices. Just high enough to compensate for the original price the prison paid for the furniture, but still so low that no other private supplier of the same product could compete with. Correctional industries can do this specifically because they employ prisoners, whose pay ranges from 55 cents to $1.55 per hour. This is also why the administration's clarifications that UW has no direct binding contracts with correctional industries don't matter all that much. Although UW always selects its suppliers through a competitive bidding process, correctional industries always comes out on top because their prices are so unbeatably low. So UW inevitably buys from them year after year.
Yeah, they could they could actually decide not to. There's about, I think, six times or so that the university has either adopted divestment or explored divestment. There's been students and folks who have asked the university to divest from these companies, and that's something the Board of Regents could do, could initiate that process, but they haven't yet.
Over the last 2 years, different student groups have approached the administration regarding divestment. Although the debates surrounding these efforts were more focused on UW's furniture purchasing, rather than their indirect investments in private prisons through other companies. When this issue was discussed, mostly during meetings between students and the Board of Regents, President Kausi was quick to bring up state law as the reason why UW can't divest from state prisons. The same has actually happened to me. When I tried to approach members of the administration for comment on their prison labor purchasing back when the prison strike was more recent, time and time again, I was referred back to that legal justification. Hopefully, it would be no surprise to hear that the administration is no easy group to get access to, especially as a student. The lack of transparency of UW administration on prison divestment specifically is especially striking. When I reached out to them for comment in response to the letter that was delivered to President Kausi's office on August 21st, I received a response from university spokesperson Victor Balta saying that the staff in the president's office doesn't even have a record of them receiving a letter, and couldn't provide comment because of that. Amani Sawari has since then resent the letter over email. This wasn't my first interaction with Balta. In fact, he was my only point of contact for anything regarding the administration's involvement with the Washington State prison system. When I tried to connect to administrators from UW Housing and Food Services with specific questions regarding the UW's relationship to Stafford Creek or to scheduled interviews, I was always redirected to Balta, who was only able to provide one statement, and it reads as follows. We fully recognize the inequities in the U.S. criminal justice system and are proud of the students, faculty, and staff who are striving to end those inequities through their studies, scholarship, and activism. Public universities and all state agencies in Washington are required by state law to include correctional industries as a bidder for relevant projects. All UW suppliers, including correctional industries, are required to adhere to the Supplier Code of Conduct, which represents the UW's values and mission. If you read through that Supplier Code of Conduct, you'll notice that correctional industries technically violates some of the terms of the code. For example, that the supplier shall pay at least the legal minimum wage in all locations in which the supplier operates. The problem is that there is another clause that says the supplier will comply with all applicable local, state, federal, and international laws. This allows correctional industries to maintain its practices, which are in fact legal, regardless of how unethical they are. But this is also why, throughout my reporting on this issue, I naturally gravitated towards the information that was accessible to me. So I'm definitely still in the dark about most of the dealings of the administration in regards to prison labor. But what I do know is that students have relentlessly continued their activism in response to the administration's apparent indifference. One of the student groups that has been at the forefront of this effort was Decolonize UW. The Race and Equity Initiative that they wrote back in 2016 included a list of demands, one of which was for UW to divest from prisons by the end of spring 2017. Obviously, that didn't happen, but it did inspire one student senator to bring prison divestment into the public conversation on campus. That senator was Ritika Jain. She's the ASUW president now.
For me, the big, like, motivator in at least thinking about it at the beginning was the divest movement that was happening my freshman year, so 2015-2016. And I think Divest UW actually came into a race and equity initiative like conversation that was taking place.
By the way, Ritika later clarified to me that she was actually referring to Decolonize UW. Divest UW is a student group that focuses more on climate issues, although they also posted an online petition in support of prison divestment at around the same time.
And kind of took over and like made sure that everyone there knew that like just having conversations about equity isn't enough, like we have to take action. And they had a list of demands, one of which included divesting from prison labor. And I learned over the next couple years about how the reason we do that is because it's part of our state law. So I looked more into it over the summer before my junior year and found a lot of like really concerning things within the state law. There's a lot of stuff. There's a lot to unpack there.
In the fall of 2017, Ritika introduced a bill titled In Opposition to the Purchase of Goods and Services by Washington State Agencies from Inmate Work Programs.
So I proposed it as a legislative directive, so essentially something that our student lobbyist in Olympia could lobby in during winter quarter when the session is in full swing.
The idea was that if the Senate passes this bill, it will be added to the legislative agenda that the ASUW drafts and finalizes every fall in collaboration with the Office of Governmental Relations. Then, when the legislative session starts in January, student lobbyists can go straight to state senators and representatives in the state capitol to promote prison divestment there.
So yeah, I definitely think that a lot of conversation about prison reform and anything to do with labor rights within prison systems is essentially racialized in the undercurrents of it because our criminal justice system is so racialized. And regardless of how much you try to remove your like lens of race from the conversation, it doesn't change the fact that our society is one that inherently considers race as an important enough part of your identity that it is something that makes you more likely to be criminalized for the same kinds of charges. I think the way that I tried to talk about it within Senate, because there's a very wide range of opinions and mindsets within that body, was try to talk about it from like a human rights perspective and how all people, regardless of their situation, their race, whether or not they're in prison, they do deserve some like base level of respect as another human being in your community.
This approach made complete sense at the time. If President Kause keeps saying that her hands are tied because she is obligated to comply with state law, why not go straight to the source of that law and abolish it there?
So essentially the mission of the OGR is to represent the voice of the students of University of Washington.
That's Lucas Garcia. He's UW's student lobbyist for the 2018-2019 school year, not last year, when this bill was discussed. He spoke to me in general about how his office works and what happened within the OGR at that time.
Like, we don't advocate on behalf of the administration. We don't advocate on behalf of the alumni. We're specifically supposed to be representing the voices of the students. We essentially, at the bottom line, like, our main goal is to represent what the students want. And so sometimes what the students want just doesn't line up with other interests from the administration or alumni or faculty.
This commitment to the concerns of students does prove to be effective most of the time. It's how we manage to secure a student loan bill of rights and financial aid opportunities for undocumented students. But while it sounds like the OGR is only interested in what students want, the administration can still control what students can actually lobby on, although they cannot influence legislative priorities or guide specific advocacy efforts. The administration is the one who outlines the scope of the OGR's lobbying.
Within the governing documents for the Office of Government Relations, and more specifically like the state lobbying efforts, we are limited to issues of higher education, which essentially comes down to teaching, tuition, and quality of life for students on campus. And so there are a lot of things that students are very vocal about that just don't fall under any of those three categories. And then so that's sort of out of the purview of our office.
So when it came down to the legislative directive in support of prison divestment, the OGR ultimately decided that it simply does not fit into the categories for lobbying that the OGR is constrained to, even though the bill passed through the Senate with 41 votes in favor, 5 were opposed, and 34 abstained.
We just have to default to you know, the documents that govern our actions. So the Board of Regents have, you know, set up essentially the guidelines for what we're supposed to be doing within the Office of Government Relations, because since we are part of ASUW and we are on a college campus, we should very much be focused within these higher educational issues and our lobbying efforts, just to follow law and procedure. That's kind of what we're constrained within. And so, yes, I understand how it could be, you know, frustrating for, you know, students to have these opinions and to have these feelings or resentment towards a given policy. But, you know, it's just kind of something that we're not able to really, you know, lobby on.
I asked Lucas about the quality of life category specifically. Since students put money into the university, which inevitably ends up being put towards UW's furniture purchases from Correctional Industries, and those same students are also using that furniture if they live on campus, to me it felt like prison divestment is relevant to student quality of life. But he explained that that's not how the OGR defined that category.
For example, on last year's legislative agenda, we had a portion on there talking about protections for undocumented citizens/students on campus. And so that is something where it doesn't necessarily have to do with the tuition that they're paying, or does it have to do with the quality of teaching that they're receiving? More so it has to do with their experience on campus. And so that goes a lot towards like their quality of life and, you know, how they're able to experience being a UW student.
Mm-hmm. Regardless of any argument you could make to show how prison divestment can still be a legitimate lobbying initiative, if you're not in a position within AECW or the administration to make those executive decisions, your personal rhetoric can only go so far. Due to the limitations of the OGR set forth by the administration, they decided that it could not be done.
Like when it comes to things like this, like prison divestment, they're sort of like borderline issues where clearly students of the University of Washington are implicated, but it doesn't necessarily fall into like my functions within my job and my responsibilities as a lobbyist. Like the students have a voice behind it, but it's not necessarily a voice that I can go and express come session in January.
So even though the bill passed through both the Student Senate and the AUCW Board of Directors, the administration still managed to indirectly block prison divestment from being pursued any further. And so the bill essentially died in this weird in-between state after students expressed their support for it, but before that student voice could be articulated to state legislators. But this also makes me wonder how far we could have gotten if this was handled differently. If the OGR actually agreed to add this initiative to the agenda and our lobbyist was able to talk to legislators about it, how much could our voice actually influence their decisions? Would there have been any interest to reform the state law? When I talked to Ritika about her work, I couldn't shake the sense of hopelessness that every avenue available for students has been completely blocked off. But Ritika remains hopeful.
Change at something as big as the University of Washington with over 40,000 students, it's going to take a lot longer for something to grow enough for, like, not only university policy to change, but also, like, state law. Something that I have been, like, told multiple times by faculty, by administrators, is that change is happening, but because students are only here for, like, 2 to 6 years, probably, makes it really difficult for students to understand any change that is happening, because it all happens on a lot slower time scale than students would like there to be, which isn't ideal, but there is some sort of hope that going into the future, that is something that will continue to be on the minds of administration, of the regents, and lawmakers across the state. Mm-hmm. So potentially some sort of hope there.
Clearly, this is not the end for the movement against prison slavery at UW. Maybe for the time being, it's out of the scope of students, but not once those students graduate. Amani Sawari is actually a UW Bothell alum. When she found out about Correctional Industries and how it operates, she was furious, but she had difficulties balancing activism with her responsibilities as a student. Now that she's doing advocacy work for prisoners full-time, she knows what students can still do on their end to show support without having to come after their administration.
Think about the fact that there are prisoners that are hunger striking right now, prisoners that are suffering from retaliation right now, and the simple thing that we have to do to stand with them. All they want us to do is just support them in not spending our money at places that exploit their labor and signing a petition and raising awareness about their demands. So I think that's easy enough for us to do on the outside, and I really encourage students to really channel the power that you have as a student and as a citizen, as a free citizen in this country. Use that power to do more than just, I partied and had fun in school as well, but use your power. Party and be powerful.
And that's episode 2. Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to read more about prison divestment at UW, you can read the article I wrote back in October that includes additional content I did not mention in this episode. That article is titled, Following National Prison Strike, Why the UW Has Continued to Buy from Prisons. Thanks again to Amani Sawari for providing us with the audio from the August demonstrations. The Civil Experiment is produced by me and The Daily's podcast editor, Dee Dee Madigan. The show's theme music was made by Ben Chelsea, and the cover art for this show was made by Rachel Connolly. Tune in next Monday when we'll talk about the student-led initiative to reform the UW's sexual assault reporting process.